Chapter 13. Present your case, if you insist. Beware the seductions of PowerPoint. In many fields of business, and therefore in many negotiations, the presentation is the formal act of showing off the product or service, stating features and benefits and prices, and requesting a formal response. This is my widget. This is what it'll do. This is why it's so much better than any other widget on the market. This is how much it costs. How many do you want to buy right now? This show and tell often follows the RFP, and on this subject, I'm probably as contrarian as I can get. To the chagrin of some of my own clients, frankly, I say that the presentation is that part of basic negotiating theory, win-win and otherwise, that the old school may feel has tremendous value, but in fact has very little, if any. I've seen many more times when the presentation was positively harmful to the presenter's standing in the negotiation, or even fatal. I say instead that the greatest presentation you'll ever give is the one your adversary never sees. I'd like to repeat that statement. The greatest presentation you will ever give is the one your adversary never sees. In opening my defense of this position, I pose these interrogative-led questions. When was the last time you hoped that the salesperson, agent, whoever, would just be quiet for 5 minutes and let you discover the offer for yourself? How many times have you walked into a store and a salesperson immediately attached himself to you like a limpet? Plenty, I imagine. Most of us would rather be left alone to look around for ourselves, and then to find help and ask questions when we're ready to. Now, how many times have you listened to formal business presentations and been moved to take action on the spot? Never, I'm betting. It's a silly formality at best, or more likely an insidious ploy to get the adversary to spill her beans to no purpose. If you've worked through your system and implanted vision and painted your adversary's pain effectively, you've made a winning presentation. One of my best clients was initially as skeptical of my system as anyone who's ever worked with me. I don't even understand why he decided to stay on board, because the system seems so contrarian as to be somehow countercultural for him, and he's not a counterculture kind of guy. But he's come to excel in his negotiations. He's in commercial real estate, where requests for RFPs are pretty much standard, except with him. It doesn't matter if he's dealing with, negotiating with, a city zoning board or a Japanese conglomerate. If he creates a clear picture of pain, with vision to follow, he does not need to make any formal presentation. This man's a good negotiator, but he's not a magician. If the system can work for him, it can work for anyone in real estate. A major tenet of my system is that you want the negotiation to take place where? In the world of the adversary. To this end, you ask interrogative-led questions, and your adversary's answers create vision for him or her. You don't tell anyone anything, remember? They have to see it for themselves. But how do most presentations work? They try to tell the adversary not just anything, but everything, and then hope against hope that the adversary goes along with what's been said. But the presentation, by definition, puts the adversary into the intellectual mode. When the adversary is in the intellectual mode, he raises objections, doesn't he? Think about this from your own experience. When someone presents to you, your instinct is to hunt for objections, quibbles, and mistakes, and you always find them. The classic presentation serves only to create objections, so you end up answering questions rather than asking them. When I frame the issue with presentations this way in workshops, I see a lot of bobbing heads in the audience. They know I'm onto something here. If you've worked effectively to paint the pain, a presentation is simply a waste of time and energy. If you have not painted the pain, the presentation is no substitute for your failure to do so, and it won't do you any good now. What are you going to present? How do you know that the points of your presentation have any interest to the adversary? You don't, because you don't know their pain. So anyone who wants to present to me is telling me that they haven't painted the pain. He doesn't know what the pain is. If he did, he wouldn't be presenting blindly, throwing mud at the wall and hoping that some of it sticks. Furthermore, a presentation shows neediness, doesn't it? Can it often seem to the adversary to be a rush to close? Can it come across as taking away the right to say no? Indeed it can, and does. Or you want to present because this negotiation is going nowhere and the presentation is your last hope. Or maybe the adversary has insisted upon the presentation as a ploy. So you do your thing and lay out all your beans and show them how great you are and accomplish what, really? Don't take my word for it. Think honestly about your own experience, and I'll bet you agree that otherwise effective negotiations have survived formal presentations, but they've never needed them. We need a presentation on your business. Well, I don't have any idea how to do that. I really don't. If I had an idea where you stand, what you need, what you're interested in, then I'd be happy to address your concerns. That's what I'm here for. What's driving you to ask me for a presentation? I mean, why do you want my widget? You've been dealing with USA widgets for 7 years. You must have the best price in the world from them by now. How could we ever compete with USA widgets? Why are you interested in Widgets International? But you called us. Yes, and I'm glad I did. I was interested in how it's going with USA widgets. There must be some reason why you invited me to this meeting. You must have some interest in something about Widgets International. I just need an idea what it is. That's not an entirely fanciful exchange. That's an effective way to deal with RFPs, an effective way to get the ball rolling, even if you have to do a little something official looking toward the end of the negotiation. One client once struck a deal worth a couple $100 million with a multinational by getting the adversary to make the presentation. After 10 or so months of serious work by my client in finding the decision-makers, always a challenge with a multinational, painting the pain, building budgets, the adversary finally asked us for our presentation of how much of our product they should buy, at what unit cost, and so on. We suggested that it made a lot more sense for them to give us their thoughts and give us a good idea where they were going and what they were trying to do. And then we could respond with ideas tailored to their requirements. That's a good idea, they said. If you insist. If, for whatever reason I oppose, you make a formal presentation, at least do it well. First, be certain that you're presenting to the real decision makers. If you make a formal presentation to the unqualified, you're spilling your beans all over the universe. Second, you must have an agenda negotiated in advance of the big day. The adversary must know, here we go, the formal presentation. The adversary must know what the presentation will contain and what it will not contain. The adversary must know that it is finally yes or no time. Maybe is not allowed as an answer following the presentation. Make sure this agreement is negotiated on an agenda. If it's not, what will you do when you hear the dreaded maybe? Finally, and I hope by this point in this book the statement almost goes without saying, always present in the world of the adversary. Granted, you're telling them things rather than letting them see by the nature of the presentation, but at least tell them things about the issues that are driving the negotiation. Present only the information that addresses your adversary's concern, the information that addresses the adversary's pain, or what you know about it, which is probably not much, or you wouldn't be presenting in the first place. Resist the temptation to throw in the kitchen sink. If the only pain is the tire's maximum carrying capacity, forget how wide your tires are. If you're trying to sell a house that has a beautiful lawn, but the buyer hasn't expressed any interest in a beautiful lawn, stifle the temptation to deliver a long spiel on the subject. Let the grass speak for itself. You can always bring it up later if the occasion arises. Addition by subtraction. This old sports adage about making your team better by getting rid of a certain player is also true for presentations. Present in the order of importance. Mr. Smith, since your most important concern is horsepower, let's look at the engine first. Then we'll check out the headroom for the driver's seat, since you're rather tall, and I know that's also important to you. Now, recall from Chapter 3 the football recruit who used my system. He never made the formal presentation of an application to the school he finally chose, and that chose him, but he did provide a demonstration, a videotape, and the key point about his demonstration pertains to presentations. Most recruits make the mistake of submitting film that is in their own world, clips of their spectacular runs, spectacular catches, touchdowns. But is this what the coach really wants to see? If it's not, if the coach's pain is elsewhere, the recruit has not presented to that pain. The way to find out is to ask the question this recruit asked of every coach. How do you evaluate a player? Isn't this question just common sense? Yes. But is it commonly asked? No. Our recruit found out that the answer varied from coach to coach and often seemed very limited. One coach was mainly interested in vertical jumping ability, another in speed, another in strength work, specifically the bench press. One coach would not recruit a defensive back under 6 feet tall, and another would not recruit any players under 6 feet tall. In any event, no coach said or implied, "Send me clips of your greatest plays." So our recruit tailored his videotape to the answers provided by each coach. He presented in the world of each specific coach, not his own world. He showed them what he had decided they wanted to see, not what he thought they should want to see or what he wanted to see of himself. That approach took a lot of discipline and a lot of work. In short, if you insist on making formal presentations, or if a hidebound or stealthy adversary insists that you make one, do it well. Stay within the system. It's perfectly okay to pull out all the stops with overheads, art, graphics, multimedia, and everything else that PowerPoint and the other software programs offer, but none of this works if you're relying on the glitz by itself to carry the day. It won't. If your high-tech presentation isn't addressed to your adversary's vision and pain, you're wasting your gigabytes. And if you've negotiated well up to this point, you've wasted them anyway. The next negotiation. What is prep in step? It's the reminder that your work in this negotiating session isn't over until you've either prepared the bridge to the next one by means of what happens next on the agenda, or until you've prepared a means of exiting the negotiation for good, ending it by fading away into the night. Prep in step works hand in hand with what happens next to ensure that the negotiation is organized and to the point. In the Network Inc. negotiation we've looked at several times, the president outlined the problem and told the adversary what he wanted for the other company to propose a solution. And then he said, "And when you've offered a solution, we will be happy to sit with you face to face. Within 24 hours' notice, my team will meet you anywhere in the world. Just call me back and tell me where." That's prep end step. That's advising the adversary of the bridge to the next negotiation. 2 days after the conference call, the adversary requested an immediate meeting in Germany. As we know, good things happened in the end. Now I switch to the negotiation introduced in Chapter 3 between the company I call Bonanza Inc. and the big multinational, the one in which Bonanza got tired of being whipsawed in competition with two other companies for a big project. Bonanza had about 15 men and women working on this deal with their various counterparts with the multinational. I'd say that, all in all, we had about 500 negotiating sessions of one sort or another, including emailed mini-negotiations. This was just a really complicated situation. Plotted on paper, all the negotiations within the negotiation would look like a tangled spider's web. In fact, however, all these bits and pieces of the negotiation fit together logically, thanks to agendas and diligent prep-in-stepping every step of the way. Not a single email or phone call was concluded without setting the stage for the next email or phone call. The end result was that Bonanza now has a special relationship with the multinational. With many multinationals, such alliances are often meaningless or even dangerous. This one isn't. Not only is your work not over after this negotiating session, it's not over after this entire negotiation is signed, sealed, and delivered. The signed contract is just another decision. Isn't this right? Contracts are broken all the time, for starters. More important, most contracts entail future obligations from both parties almost by definition. Agreements have been made to do something. Some good or service has to be delivered, exchanged, or bartered by one party or another, or by both. Something has to work right. Something's guaranteed. So drink the champagne by all means, but don't then drop your guard. Be ready for more negotiations. As history has demonstrated all too often over the past millennia, keeping the peace is much more important and usually much more difficult than signing the peace treaty. That's what prep-in-step is all about. Prep End Step is also about how to end the negotiation short of agreement. It happens in straight sales. It happens in proposed multi-billion-dollar corporate mergers. You have a budget for the negotiation. You have your mission and purpose. And this deal just isn't going to happen. This finally becomes clear. You decide the time has come to retire. When this happens, I recommend the calm, quiet, thanks but no thanks, maybe next time. To my mind, this fadeaway is far more effective than burning bridges. I hate to see clients burn their bridges, no matter how ill-served they feel. For one thing, it betrays neediness on their part. They wouldn't feel the temptation to burn bridges if they didn't have too much invested emotionally. For another, who knows what'll happen in the future? Complete changes of heart or mind are not unknown, after all. I just can't see any advantage to burn bridges except some kind of short-term self-validation, and that kind of neediness is not good enough, not in my system. One final story about the value of Prep End Step, a fairly long but instructive one. One of my early students, Eric, was a college dropout working like his father in the life insurance business, a real crucible for negotiation skills. One of Eric's first sales calls was with an elderly lady living in a retirement center. He found the lady's pain. She had $1/3 million sitting in the bank. Helped her see this pain. She could do a whole lot better. Had a budget, understood her decision-making process, and established an agenda with which he would try to help the lady fix her pain. When Eric's sales manager found out the size of the negotiation, he became excited, sales manager fashion, and insisted that he go along to help Eric close the deal. Eric immediately negotiated a separate deal with the sales manager. He could come along, but only if he kept his mouth shut. He knew nothing about Eric's system of negotiation. He could blow it. The negotiation opened as planned and went extremely well with our 19-year-old negotiator and his 67-year-old adversary. She decided to give Eric 3 checks for $100,000 each. At this point, Eric did exactly what Prep End Step, Never Close, the 3-plus technique, and nurturing call for. He slid the 3 checks back across the table to his prospective client and asked her, "Are you sure this is what you want to do? I don't want you to do this unless you're sure this is something you want to do." He gave the client every opportunity in the world to say no. Almost predictably, the conventional sales manager started to interrupt, but Eric kicked him under the table. Now I'll let Eric pick up the story as he related it later to me. "Jim, I was comfortable, but I thought my sales manager was going to have a heart attack. He had no concept of what I was doing. He didn't see that I was preparing for the next negotiation. Of course, I wanted to help my client, but I also wanted to get my referral system in high gear. And if this wasn't handled properly, I'd receive no referrals from this lady. As the meeting closed, I spoke privately with her. She whispered that when I came back with the other documents I needed to deliver, I shouldn't bring the other fellow with me. She didn't know why, but she didn't trust him. 2 days later, she called to tell me she'd been talking with her friends at the retirement community, and they'd like to invite me over to discuss how I might help them like I helped her. Jim, I am convinced Prep End Step was the key to gaining 11 new clients." I'm convinced Eric was right.